do really believe that before we change the world out there, we have to change ourselves internally to some degree.
Welcome to your heavenly refuge, a space to unwind your mind, slow down your rhythm, and fill your whole body up with inspiration.
Dreaming with open eyes, being in another world. Don't know what's truth or lie, all these stories that you've heard. Having difficulties to speak, because they seem so far away. It is time to be awake, got important things to say.
This podcast will nourish you with stories from beautiful creators and entrepreneurs who have already made a change in their life using their gifts to walk their talk. Welcome again. My name is Oyana Galor Dual, yoga teacher and nutrition consultant, enthusiastic about bringing the stories of people that share their unique blueprint with the world. Today's guest in Ibiza Refuge for Dreamers is Rory Spowers. Rory is a father, writer, campaigner, and event creator. He specializes in systems of change, ecological, and consciousness issues. He has written A Year in Green Tea and Tuk Tuk, covering the creation of Samarkanda, an ecological center in South Sri Lanka, and Rising Tides, a history of ecological thought. He has been a writer for Bruce Perry's documentary Tawai, which explores humanity's separation from nature. He is the creative director of the Tiringam Institute, a world-class think tank for consciousness studies, and lead curator for Amore Food and Consciousness Festivals and Events. Welcome, Rory.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Before getting into dialogue about regeneration, I like to start each episode asking the guest to describe turning moments in their life. And because of the topic today, I would ask you to specifically talk about moments in your life which help you to shift consciousness.
Thank you. That's a really fabulous, wonderful question to kick off. Thank you, Oyana. Definitely some of the traveling I was lucky enough to do in my late teens and during my 20s, particularly in India and Africa. I did a long cycling trip from South Africa back to London when I left university when I was 23 with three other friends, and that got me into writing. And a few years later, at the end of my 20s, I walked from South India up to Calcutta. But I'd also done a lot of traveling in Asia around that time as well. And I guess all of those trips, especially the early ones, especially coming out of the privileged education and things that I've been exposed to in my childhood, that to suddenly realize that a lot of what I'd been educated and conditioned to believe in wasn't necessarily true, and particularly around our sort of ingrained notions about what constituted progress and development and the culture that we were sort of exporting to the developing world. And one could just see in real time just how this was yes, obviously bringing some new levels of affluence on some level, but at such great costs on so many other levels. And that was really what sort of kickstarted my journey into particularly the sort of ecological arena, but lots of other things too. Psychedelics have obviously played an enormous part. I think most people who've had a profound psychedelic experience would reiterate that that's probably been one of the profound sort of shifts, because I think you then have this sort of catalytic experience where, again, what you'd sort of previously been conditioned or educated to believe or in or think about what consciousness was suddenly also thrown up into the air. And that was, I suppose, in a way, the beginning of my journey to recognize, well, maybe consciousness wasn't actually this weird phenomenon created by the firing of neurons inside my skull, but something, you know, infinitely more mysterious and more universal. But then there were also, I was always, from a very young age, for whatever reason, fascinated by India and Eastern mysticism and philosophy, and spent a lot of time there, and a lot of time in a number of ashrams and with all sorts of teachers and gurus, and delved down numerous paths. So there were certainly people I met along the way there, and experiences that I had that were yes, more profound than anything else, you know, certainly more profound than any of the psychedelic experiences, or they were the sort of really the major shifts. And they're, of course, sort of quite hard to talk about in the sense of how to describe them. But certainly, particularly through Ramana Maharshi, this Indian teacher sage who died in 1950, but was really the sort of 20th century exponent of this particular Indian Vedantic teaching, called Advaita Vedanta, which is at the sort of core of the sort of non-duality teachings, which have become very popularized in the last 20 years through people like Deepak Chopra and Eckhart Tolle, who've really taken these ancient teachings and translated them into a much more sort of commercial mainstream way. But the essence of what they're saying there is, sort of remains the same. So there were some experiences, yes, in India that had a profound shift. But I suppose the most profound thing for me has been those moments of recognizing that consciousness might actually be primary and not secondary. And what I mean by that is that it's something I am within, and it's not something that's within me, i.e., you know, my sense of personalized, individualized consciousness is just a subjective experience, and that is just not the full story. And the Ramana's analogy, I think, about the cinema screen and the projector and all of that is probably for me the most profound, where when you're looking at a movie, you're so engrossed in the story and the actors on the stage, it all seems so real. But when the movie comes to an end and the screen is blank, the screen is still there. What Ramana is suggesting is that, you know, what you really are is the screen and not the images that are projected onto the screen. But of course, the great sort of the Maya, the great sort of delusion, the spell that we're under is to believe or to have restricted this infinite and eternal universal consciousness into this mind-body organism, into this sort of three-dimensional skull, and believe that that's all it is. And that in itself is what separates us as individual egos from the rest of it. So that's when the wave separates itself from the ocean and forgets that it's actually part of the ocean all the time, and it's always been nothing but water.
You mentioned that different experiences throughout your journeys, and you mentioned that you were witnessing that Western culture was evolving and affecting other parts of the planet that maybe you were already not so happy about, or you were maybe more conscious than other people about the facts that our way of thinking in the West or our way of growing in such a big speed was affecting other places in the world. Was that what gave you the impulse to create this ecological resort or place in Sri Lanka?
No, absolutely. And the place in Sri Lanka, I think a lot of people who come from this kind of sort of activist arena, and absolutely, I know that the strong argument that people who are so concerned with seeing things wrong in the world out there often see things, often it's the deflection of recognizing the things that might be wrong inside themselves. And I've seen that all the time. And so I do really believe that before we change the world out there, we have to sort of change ourselves internally to some degree. Well, absolutely. But also, I suppose that one of the anomalous things that really hit me through that traveling in my late teens and early 20s was having been so, and admitting, this was the late 80s, sort of Thatcherite sort of yuppiedom going on in the UK. And I had friends who weren't even 20, making extraordinary amounts of money and driving Porsches and the rest of it in London. And it all, you know, all looked very glamorous and attractive. But of course, then you recognise that the happiest people you'd ever encountered through travelling in some of these places had none of these things. And that actually most of the people you knew who were very affluent weren't very happy. And in fact, there was almost like a kind of sort of a, the richer they were, the more messed up and less happy they were. I mean, this is not always the case, like all generalizations. But there was a dissonance there, which just made me realize, well, look, these aspirations that we've been conditioned into just don't stack up. They're just, this is just driven by an economic ideology. Mm-hmm. And advertising and propaganda, stroke PR spin, and that, you know, the rest of it. So that was definitely clear to me early on that if being happy was the sort of ultimate aspiration in life, that it didn't necessarily come about through material accumulation of objects. There's something much more profound to look into there, and that actually, if one found out what happiness was really, what led towards happiness, and if that, then think about, you know, the money, maybe, because it didn't seem to work the other way around, as far as I could see. You know, people who were driven by making lots of money and then thought they would sort of get, you know, sort, yeah, it didn't seem to work like that. So I could, that was part of it, but also this recognition, I suppose, that look, of course, I'm not anti-science or anti-progress. I recognise the extraordinary benefits that have come through all sorts of, you know, medical advances, scientific advances. And I'm not in any way anti or in opposition to that. It's just the way we apply these things and the goalposts, you know, what's driving this. And if it's just the accumulation of objects and the accumulation of numbers in people's bank accounts, it doesn't really reflect into a genuine prosperity or elevation of quality of life. So we've sort of muddled up our indicators and parameters of what point, you know, GDP, gross domestic product. So we're evaluating prosperity and essentially quality of life and people's happiness with an index that is so deeply flawed. Because it's increasing every time all sorts of things that any sane person would regard as being negative, you know, like a hospital bill, a legal, you know, environmental oil spill, all sorts of things, but which purely add to GDP. So it doesn't, and all biological organisms grow. Well, yeah, this is a fundamental aspect of biology, but also then they get to a point where they stop growing and they just develop, because to keep growing is, you know, there's an American novelist, Edward Abbey, who wrote a book called The Monkey Wrench Gang, which led to a formation of a very radical eco-activist group called Earth First in America, who wanted to sort of blow up dams and all sorts of stuff. But he once said, you know, growth for the sake of growth is the philosophy of the cancer cell. Yeah. And I just find it, you know, absolutely staggering, really, that, because there was prominent economist in the 1950s, you know, Herman Daly first pointed this out, that the growing economy is just getting bigger, a developing economy is getting better. But here we are in, you know, beginning of 2020s, and still seemingly our politicians and economists have failed to grasp some fundamental sort of logical flaws within their argument that the infinite growth on a finite planet with finite resources ain't going to work. But this is still the sort of central tenet, really, that's the sort of driving this extraordinary sort of behemoth of an ideological beast that is basically driving the whole thing to a catastrophic conclusion.
Okay, and before getting into the global situation, I'm still more curious about your personal background, because it feels like there is certain parallelism between like the creation of Samarkanda. It feels like you could experiment there already with agriculture, with other ways of living. Then manifested, or maybe you put them more like in a system.
No, exactly. So, and again, I was rambling. But Samarkanda really was an attempt to walk the talk and put these things into practice. And it's all very well to sort of get up on your soapbox and rant about these things and write books and the rest of it. But if you can't actually integrate them into your life or show any kind of embodied evidence of them being in any way realistic and functional and plausible, then obviously. So we were trying to do it in on a Welsh hillside before moving to Sri Lanka with challenging conditions and a very short growing season. A beautiful place, but difficult conditions. Uh-huh. And Yvette, my ex-wife, who you know, lives on the island, grew up in the Caribbean, and the weather in mid Wales didn't seem to be too favourable. Took me a while to get my head. But it ended up being Sri Lanka being the place that we went to, and for all sorts of reasons. And we bought this phenomenal piece of land that had all the qualities that one would look for for something like that. It was the highest point in the area, so it had no runoff from neighbouring agricultural projects. It hadn't had it was an abandoned tea estate, hadn't had any chemicals used in at least 30 years or so. It had incredible water sources, wells everywhere, river on one side, phenomenal trees, phenomenal wildlife, and a big bit of land, way bigger than anything I'd ever contemplated buying. And we still have it. And the irony is, I bought it, I suppose, really, definitely for our children's future, seeing what I felt was coming. And the irony being, of course, now that, things are really kicking in, would be a phenomenal place to be. But we've all sort of fallen in love with the beat there. And I mean, ecologically, it would be a more sensible place to be. But from a community point of view, Abita is what resonates so deeply with all of us, as a family. So Sri Lanka, was an attempt to kind of, put these things, to create a kind of demonstration working site. And so when I went to this 2002 UN summit in Joburg to launch this earlier initiative called the Web of Hope, which was this sort of online, world's first online database of sustainable lifestyle solutions, which was what it was. And it was a sort of earlier iteration of what I'm doing now. But it was an amazing experience because I met so many of these incredible people that I'd admired from afar for many years, from Vandana Shiva in America and Wangari Maathai in Kenya, just incredible indigenous activist leaders and anthropologists and all sorts. But the big thing in the kind of activist sort of forum there was about creating these ecological education centres around the world, that we needed these sort of nodal points where people could come and immerse themselves for a few weeks in learning the skills for sort of self-reliance and resilience and sort of regenerative processes, not just agriculturally, but in terms of energy issues and water issues and all sorts, so that they could then take that knowledge back to their own community. And then, this was how the self-replication of these ideas would work.
Yeah.
And to create this kind of distributed, decentralized, bottom-up grassroots model, which I would argue is the only possible viable alternative for a human future. And if there is to be a human future, this is what will, the only logical thing that can arise from the sort of collapsing rubble of the old. I just can't, having spent a long time trying to sort of believe that we could actually reform the current ideologies.
Mm.
I think it became pretty clear to me, you know, quite some time ago that, that this is impossible and not going to happen. So then it's this is why this Buckminster Fuller quote has always been so predominant for me, that you cannot create change by fighting the existing reality. You have to build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And this is how sort of successful evolution happens. It, not just in sort of design, product design, and but the fashion industry, and but social change too. It's it, and the and shifts in scientific paradigms. It's when there is, when enough people look through Galileo's telescope, and Copernicus and Kepler and Bruno and all of these guys, who basically, you know, that was the sort of big paradigm shift in human history, I'd say, or one of them. But they were, of course, vilified, smeared, and declared as heretics and extremists until enough people looked through the telescope to go, well, actually, you might be onto something here. And yes, we need to sort of upgrade and update our operating system to integrate that. And sadly, you know, and that again, I think this is sort of where we're at now in a different kind of way.
Do you think humanity is upgrading after the events of the last year, that it affected so much all of us? Do you think that humanity is going through like a rock bottom, let's say, so it awakens to a new reality? What is your opinion on that?
I think this is incredibly interesting, and of course no one's got a crystal ball and no one really knows, but it's really, when anyone thinks how radically the world has changed in the last 15 months, it is just quite staggering. and I suppose, look, I hope it all sort of might return to some level of normality and how things were sort of prior to 2020, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's unlikely. I really don't see any indication of that. And I hate to be a sort of prophet of doom, which I find often now, but realistically, I don't see things getting any better. So I think there's a sort of a convergence of things going on here. And I think that on multiple levels, and one can look at this sort of meta crisis through so many different lenses, and it can and reach all sorts. And then the sort of the dissonance is by sort of mixing up those lenses, and thinking that, and we can get to that. But I think that's why that's part of the confusion, and we are going through this paradigm shift, and that is also part of it, because people can't correlate the official narrative for the official science with what they might intuitively feel or what they're hearing from another source. And these are incredibly complex and nuanced things, and they get reduced into incredibly sort of simplistically polarized binary arguments that do no justice to the reality of what's going on, but is a very convenient way for the status quo to sort of maintain its agenda and basically to sort of dismiss anybody who doesn't agree with it as being just a conspiracy theorist or nutter or whatever. So, but I do think the deeper question there, I mean, I think this notion of planetary initiation, a term that my friend Daniel Pinchbeck, who coined a few years ago, it's really sort of hit home to me in the last year that, yes, I think we are all being sort of confronted with very sort of profound psychological issue, emotional issues about how to integrate this new world and this information. And I think also you could argue that it's almost, we're witnessing the sort of collapse of the sort of rational thinking mind. It's getting a bit metaphysical, but I think the recognition that this very language-based left brain kind of rational analytical way of looking at the world,
yeah,
is no longer equipped or adequate for understanding what's going on. That actually we're recognizing the limitations of that. And so this right-brained, feminine, intuitive aspect that's been sort of educated out of us over the last few hundred years, but particularly more and more so in the last 100 years, because it's working in a language that doesn't satisfy the metrics of the left brain sort of materialist reductionist. So anything that can't be measured empirically doesn't exist, or it just dismisses and vilifies in a way. So in a junk DNA, which the sort of reductionist geneticists have sort of disregarded this, 95% of the genome, because they don't understand it. But of course, we now know from people like Bruce Lipton and others that this is really the cutting edge. This is where the stuff is, things are really happening. But we've got this, you know, totally distorted impression that, you know, from the sort of Dawkins selfish gene brigade, that it's all in the genes. Well, it's, you know, the genes are important, but they're triggered by the epigenetic context. Yeah. So this new biology, I think, is like the kind of Copernican revolution. And again, it's like that it was, and again, and the Hubble telescope. So the telescopes into deep space are redefining our cosmology and our understanding of deep space and deep time and dark matter, dark energy, these things that, you know, classical physics can't deal with because it doesn't understand them. Soil biology, what we now understand about soil carbon, you know, the essence of the regenerative, you know, again, you know, this has all happened in the last, you know, when I wrote Rising Tides, we didn't know this stuff, or it was only just emerging. The microbiome, the virome. So there are an awful lot of very interesting virologists out there who've got a very, very different story to tell you about viruses. And what's actually going on, and exosomes, and, you know, we won't go down that necessarily, but I think, you know, again, it's the science that's become institutionalized and is now being put into the center of the of government and the rest of it. While not necessarily wrong, it's just not necessarily fully right, and it's because it's predicated on taking certain, looking through a certain lens, reaching certain conclusions, certain assumptions, which can seem correct through that lens. But when seen through a more systemic lens, they then reveal, and this is, say, what we've done to the soil and what we've done to the microbiome, we're now doing to the virome. And it's a simplistic, I think, and fueled by human hubris and people thinking they're, you know, much more clever than, you know. Well, they're clever, but is it really intelligent? Is it really wise? Is it, you know, and the ramifications, you know, when we look at what we've managed to do to the soil through chemical applications, what we've managed to do to human health through pharmaceutical interventions, what we might now be doing to the virome. Anyway, it's terrifying. So I think, yes, this is a unique time. I think, you know, those of us who've been sort of working in this area for a long time always felt that the 2020s was probably going to be when a lot of these things were really going to start to converge. You know, so these latest UN studies, it's something like over a third of the world population with serious water shortages by 2025. That's sort of over 2.5 billion people. I mean, this is big stuff. And the disruption to seasonal rainfall patterns now having such an impact on crop harvests, you know, that have, you know, seriously down in the last couple of years. We're going ever faster, ever deeper into some very challenging times. And yeah, I don't think there's any way out of that. I think, I think there's probably knowledge at a very high level, and has been for a long time, that this was on the way. I don't think it could possibly be disputed. I mean, the data was there in the late 60s, early 70s. And ironically, a lot of the early ecological data was compiled by the petrochemical companies in the early 70s. So it's not as if this stuff hasn't been known about.
Let's say we were getting signs from different, like from maybe ecology, from health. We were getting signs that there was something not working, but it was not really addressed. And maybe through this global crisis, we have maybe an opportunity to make our society or culture maybe a little bit more holistic, or maybe a little bit more integrated, or maybe a little bit more systemic. I'd love you to talk a bit about the meaning of these three words.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I think... I think it's important to stress, you know, that this is, you know, so much of what I intuitively sort of feel to be almost inevitable I really wish I didn't believe. I really, but at the same time, wishing not to believe it doesn't. I often talk about the optimist, pessimist, realists. Yeah, the optimists wait for the wind to change. The pessimist says it won't, and the realist sets the sails. And I think all of us kind of fall into one of those three camps. I think, a lot of people just think, we'll get through it. Technology will sort us out or whatever. Pessimists don't really care. Anyway, and then there's a small minority of people who look at what's going on and want to try and do something about it. And if there is then a sort of successful evolutionary change that sort of integrates some new insights and understanding and transcends what came before, then it's driven by, those people, by that minority. And this is how, how things happen. But I think it's unrealistic to believe that, the coming decade and beyond is not going to bring some extremely challenging, catastrophic stuff. It really, I suppose, through an ecological lens, there will be plenty of people who will tell you there's, it's just way too late to do anything meaningful. And that as soon as we've passed this sort of 2-degree threshold, we're in a kind of runaway scenario anyway, because anything that we do then is only, is just going to be insignificant compared to the sort of compounding feedback loops, methane releases and all of this. So I think that there is an argument that it might be too late to do anything on an ecological level. The ideological crisis that's created the ecological crisis is now sort of offered its kind of like absolute sort of zenith mission via sort of transhumanism and this sort of centralized sort of technocracy thing, and ultimately, and I think what we're seeing unfold around the world now ultimately is a sort of supranational technocratic transhumanist response to the severity of the ecological crisis. Now, I think that is the only way to really explain the anomalies of what we're seeing unfolding, but that's a whole sort of another issue. So I think the reality is we're going to see ecological issues, a confluence of them, water, famine, food shortages, leading to migrations, all sorts of kind of sort of systemic sort of collapse scenarios. And I think this is just inevitable. The real question, I suppose, is what comes out the other side of that, if anything, and how does one respond to that information? What does one do? And again, it's impossible to know where's going to be safe, if anything's going to be safe. These are complex systems. However sophisticated our computer models are, we'll never really know. So places might start to get anomalous rainfall that don't have it before and end up having a sort of new agricultural renaissance. And areas that have not just suddenly just desertify massively, and we're seeing this go on. All these big land masses are desertifying from the core outwards. So I think that for me, it's just the recognition of that if that's what's coming, that you can't reform what the ideologies that are driving this, and revolution just doesn't really seem to kind of get us anywhere, except potentially replace one broken system with another broken system, and is usually a fairly sort of violent, grisly affair. Whereas this term renaissance, or now a regenerative renaissance, for me it's about withdrawing your compliance and your consent to wherever you can to all of these forces. If you're in disagreement with it, then just make sure that you're doing everything in your power to stop supporting it. And that comes largely through your sort of, if you've got investments, if you've got sort of financial interests, just really be diligent about where your investments are. Are you supporting big ag, big oil, big pharma, big tech in any way? And in just withdraw that support however you can. Take your money, close your high street bank account, look into ethical banking, just stop supporting these things that are basically going to destroy our futures and the rest of the planet left unchecked, and are doing a pretty good job at doing so already. So I think it's then about, you know, how, and I think again, one of the things that's been happening in the last 50 months with all of this is a massive recalibration for all of us, and people looking at you know, what really is important in my life. You know, all of this kind of, suddenly everything's kind of up in the air, and all sorts of things you took for granted before. Suddenly it's, you know, well, if I'm not going to be able to travel there, and if So I think ultimately it's about bringing back as much control as you possibly can over your essential human needs, predominantly obviously food and water, but shelter, housing, power, transport, and to be immersed within a community that is built on as the most sort of resilient, self-reliant principles possible. You know, to know that if the ship goes down and those centralized services and that infrastructure isn't there, what would your life look like, and how are you going to? And of course, someone living in an urban environment, you know, listening to what I'm saying now, just think I'm mad, or what hope do I have? To be brutally honest, I think it's going to be like really, really challenging for people in urban environments. But then again, at the same time, there are all sorts of urban communities doing incredible things around the world with urban agriculture, rooftop gardening, indoor. Yeah. So it's, and there'll be people in rural environments who think they've done everything possible to, and end up, you just never know. I mean, I always remember this sort of famous story and the sort of, when I was a child in the late 70s, and this chap had in America gone off to Alaska and built a log cabin because he was terrified about nuclear holocaust, and he just finished building his log cabin. And literally the next day, a satellite dropped out of the sky and dropped on his house, on his log cabin, and took him out. So, you know, you can run away from a perceived danger and only walk straight into another. So I think this is always important to remember. No one knows for sure. But I think to have as much control as possible, and the food system is where this is where change can happen. This is how the greatest opportunity. Those who are concerned about these issues, the greatest opportunity for change is through the food system, for sure.
Let's talk about new paradigms. So yeah. We say it's very difficult to change an old or broken paradigm. It's imperative to kind of go to a new one. So I'd love you to talk about the regenerative system and about the six pillars or systems of change.
No, absolutely. So I think there's this very important distinction, I think, between incremental change and sort of systemic change or step change. So, and it goes back to what we were just talking about, the difference between reform and revolution and renaissance. So, and that's why, again, I think the term regeneration was suddenly very appealing, because it was a sort of a new language that kind of moved on from the sustainability agenda, which was so co-opted already by the sort of corporate and political interests. And sustainability anyway, I mean, why sustain something that's fundamentally broken, and incrementally changing that something that's fundamentally flawed at a kind of ideological level is only going to make something a little less broken than it was before. And sustainability, as my brother likes to say, was just about doing business a little less badly than before. It's not about actually systemically shifting the whole thing.
That's it. Regeneration feels more about creating a net or creating.
Well, I think my oldest brother is a car engineer, and he's spent the last decade or more designing a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. But because the vehicle he's designed is literally just, it's not just the technology, but it's the whole way the car is designed and marketed. I mean, there's hardly material apart from a bit of rubber on the tires. You know, there's nothing in there that comes out of a conventional car manufacturer, because it's hydrogen fuel cells, microelectronics, composite fibers, all of these things. But so then you look at the sort of conventional car industry that has got massive investment, capital in its factories and its assembly lines, but also a sort of a design process that's built around it, to suddenly actually kind of make a sort of quantum leap into a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle with completely different, you know, there's just, you've got, again, you just got this sort of invested momentum in something, and just to sort of stop it one day and change it something else just ain't going to happen. And this is, so we've got this momentum in the climate system and the ecological crisis, and we've got momentum within this sort of ideological crisis driving the sort of political and economic thing. And so it's, you can't just sort of stop it. You can't just, it's just going to keep going. So I think that was one of the distinctions I wanted to make with this sort of regeneration sort of platform, was A, seeing the emergence of regenerative agriculture and how our understanding around soil biology and soil carbon was basically kind of really, you know, changing our understanding of climate change on a number of levels, not least that the way we've again sort of vilified carbon within this whole kind of process as being some sort of evil. Yeah, carbon is the sort of fundamental building block of all biological life, but because this ideology needs a villain, whether it's a terrorist or a virus or carbon, and then it has to be, you know, zero COVID, zero carbon. I mean, these are just sort of ludicrous goals to be striving towards, really. Carbon is a fundamental, and the carbon cycle is a fundamental aspect of biological life. But, and if we actually dismantle the industrial agribusiness and monocultures, and we actually, you know, did reform, rebirth the food system around small and diverse, medium scale, diversified regenerative farms using these principles, this would be the single way to, I believe, to, and lots of other people, to systemically recorrect all of these issues. Because first of all, you're drawing carbon back into the soil at a phenomenal rate. So I mean, some of the statistics around this are extraordinary, that actually you only got to raise the average organic soil content of 2% of the world's agricultural land by, is it 0.2%? Anyway, not very much. Yeah, and this could be done in a generation, some people even say in a decade. So then, not only then do you recorrect soil health and local bioregional sort of ecosystem health, bring back, you know, because at the moment, you know, all of the absence of all, you know, 95% drop in insects is a really terrifying indicator of imminent ecological collapse. But so that then recorrects the soil biology. This then recorrects our diet and nutrition, local economies, local communities, resilience, health, upstream health, preventive health. I mean, there's gets people back out on the land and engage with nature. I mean, literally, deal with everything, I believe, from the mental health crisis to all sorts of health issues, to ecological health, you know, recreate the climate system, you know, create localized bioregional resilient economies. But of course, it's the absolute sort of antithesis of the dominant ideology that wants us all eating, you know, bloody lab-grown meat and all of this nonsense. You know, these people who really literally seem to don't believe that the biological world has any role to play. You know? Yeah. That somehow it's sort of not really necessary.
Could you talk a little bit more about these six pillars of the regenerative culture? Yes, for example, what would you say about health, for example, or economics or community? Yes, for the people that are not so used to the term.
Absolutely. So the regenerative farming thing was what got me really going into this, you know, two or three years ago, around this sort of regenerative kind of culture, because I could also see how this could then be applied to all of these different pillars, these different areas, but also to try and take people on a journey, a sort of educational journey. And I think it does start with food, which is intimately connected with health, not just human health, but ecological health, soil health.
And human health, for sure.
Nutrition. Exactly. So those two are sort of coupled together. But I think, so it starts with food, and then we look at health. So when I talk about regenerative health, and again, if you look up regenerative health online, you'll find it leads you into all sorts of weird sort of stem cell stuff and God knows what. So again, it's a term that's been co-opted. But what I mean really is looking at sort of biological and functional medicine, preventative upstream medicine, intelligent use of appropriate supplements and diet and, you know, all sorts of sensible, and all these things that are free, you know, like walking on the ground barefoot, you know, for 20 minutes, now showing to reduce, you know, inflammation by 20%.
I really like this term that you use, upstream health.
Right.
And can you just also...
Yeah, so I think that, and again, this is very much sort of, I think, part of this whole kind of, you know, change. You know, we are... So the ideology we've been conditioned into, and particularly when you look at the way that the medical industry deals with chronic and systemic conditions, and this is again an important, you know, I'm just full of admiration for the miracles that modern medicine has done on so many levels with for acute conditions and all sorts of things, and I'm in no way diminishing all of that. What I am pointing to, though, are the what I, you know, many people see as the flaws when it comes to dealing with chronic and systemic conditions, because it is only able to apply a pharmaceutical drug product downstream to address the symptoms of the disease. It never really addresses the root cause. So it can, but because it suppressed the symptoms. Say you've got a skin condition, it gives you a pill, and it sort of feels validated that it's been successful. But of course, it's just, you simply cannot add a non-biological agent to a biological organism without creating a systemic side effect. You know, this is a sort of biological axiom. You know, and that's why, you know, the average 60-year-old in America is on 10 different medications, because 9 of those medications are dealing with the side effects of the medication that came before.
For sure, yeah.
So when I talk about, but of course the pharmaceutical industry predicated on the economics that we find ourselves stuck with, yeah, it really isn't interested in keeping you, making you healthy. It's interested in selling you drugs, and it's interested in making you take drugs for the rest of your life. And, and so the notion that, and that's why things like the psychedelics are so disruptive for them, because the notion of somebody, you know, being cured of 20 years of depression with 2 or 3 ketamine or psilocybin sessions or, you know, it's just anathema, because it's just like, well, you fix them and now they're going to go home and they're not going to buy our drugs anymore. So it's like the arms industry, you know, it's just like... This is just, I'm afraid, what our world is based upon, and these are the dominant forces that are driving it, is the need of these enormous corporate interests to keep generating profits in any way possible. So it's woefully ill-equipped for dealing with, you know, it doesn't look upstream. So preventative upstream health is about just making sure you don't get ill.
Yeah,
and so,
for sure.
I'd say there's an awful lot of evidence that if you keep your acid alkali balance, you know, between a particular pH range, you just simply won't get sick, or you're very unlikely to. Yeah. That all cancers, you know, thrive in these acidic environments. That all of our, you know, modern diet is predominantly acidic. That it's very hard to maintain a correct acid alkali balance without being pretty conscientious about it.
Yes.
You really got to, you know. You really got to be careful, because everything coming your way, and even things like the EMFs and the rest of it are affecting this too. So it's not just, you know, the food and drinks you're putting in. So I think, yes, regenerative health, I'm just fascinated with, I think the whole sort of health paradigm is going through a massive of change, obviously, and there's a particular direction that Big Pharma wants it to go, which is in this sort of telemedicine and just endless vaccines and yada, yada, yada. And then there's this kind of sort of more naturopathic, biologically based, you know, functional medicine and a lot of these, most of these people are conventionally trained in the medical establishment, but have recognized limitations and have recognized the efficacy of all of these other traditions, and they've integrated in them to create their own methodologies. And so they are interested in getting to the root of the problem. So on with the six pillars. Then the economics and community again sort of feel come together on that. That following on from that, if one's recreated the local food system to sort of regenerate health, not just in the human population, but bioregionally, this is the foundation then for a resilient and self-reliant regenerative community and economic system that is about reorientating everything into the local economy and doing whatever one can to sidestep the corporate global casino. So I accept that most people are forced to shop in supermarkets just because it's cheaper. I think people who can afford not to shop in supermarkets and who are concerned with these issues should absolutely never go to a supermarket. That is one of the most, I'd say, most effective ways to be basically sort of contributing to this. Because if you could support a local farmer and a local producer and a local shop, these are all the people that have been put out of business now. And these are the people that are the lifeblood of a local community. And if you really think that, and I relish it so much, to feel part of that. And if suddenly just everything is being delivered by drones and ordered online, and it's just this relentlessly sort of dehumanizing aspect that is driven by the technology. It's sort of it's inherent within it. And I find that really, really, really challenging.
It was really weird when the governments were like advising people to buy in these big supermarkets instead of going to the local sources and to the local farmers. Was a very weird advice they gave.
Yes.
Very, very weird. And more in Ibiza that we have so much local farmers and more regenerative agriculture and initiatives to support. We are so lucky here.
I think the potential is huge. But I think we're still a long way from the island being able to support itself. But it's definitely possible. And it's obviously happened in the past. And then, sorry, just to finish on those six topics, that are culture and consciousness kind of come together at the end. And that really a regenerative culture is sort of built on the foundations of those previous four pillars, and that our attitude towards science and technology, but also the role of artists and musicians and all of that, is all informed by all of that. And then consciousness comes at the end, which arguably could come at the beginning, but of course it's a term that is a red flag for a lot of people. Along with the word spiritual, after talking about metaphysical as a way to sidestep that, because people have all of these barriers as soon as you start talking about things that some people just feel is sort of immediately sort of too woo-woo or something. But it is actually at the crux of it, because it arguably should come first. Yeah. Because really, until we start to think differently, we can't do it to think differently. And that really is, the famous Oscar Wilde quote, doing things over and over again the same way being the definition of insanity. But, this is what's happening, and we're just doing it ever faster in an ever more amplified fashion, because the technologies at our disposal are now sort of exponential. So once you've married artificial intelligence and nanotech and biotech with this kind of ideology, we're really into some extremely dangerous territory. And that is, and I'm afraid, it's all, sadly, rather more evolved than I think most of us would like to believe. And I think that's been one of the big penny drops or sort of revelations for me in the last year, is to recognise that this whole sort of transhumanist agenda is more evolved than we'd like to think on some levels. But again, like all of these things, it's also sort of predicated on some completely wild and unproven speculations about what this technology is going to bring and do. And this is always the thing, in the 1950s, we were told that nuclear power was going to give us energy too cheap to meter by the end of the century. But the reality is, I haven't checked this in the last 10 years or so, but certainly 10 years ago or more. So not a single nuclear power station in the world had ever produced beyond 50% of its projected capacity. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a single nuclear power station around the world would still be in existence without enormous government subsidies. So it's a flawed technology, but it's been presented to us as being absolutely essential. And this is, again, you know, we just see this time and time again.
Do you think we could give technology and all this science we developed for so many, for the last years, let's say, maybe not so long as we think, but for the last years, could we weave it with the cycles of nature? Could we weave it with the indigenous wisdom and consciousness?
No, totally. So I think there's this whole very exciting area known as biomimicry. This is a fantastic book by Janine Benyus, which, I mean, is probably 20 years old now. But and this is a really exciting area where the blueprints or the inspiration for these designs are all being drawn from nature. So people are designing photovoltaic cells inspired by leaves of trees, because the leaf of a tree is the most effective mechanism available to us for turning solar energy into other energy, for, in this case, through photosynthesis. I think that the ceramic tiles on the outside of the space shuttle were inspired by looking at sort of abalone shells or something, and they recognised that spiders spin webs, what they actually spin, the thread is 8 times stronger than steel without needing all sorts of heavy external inputs. So all of these extraordinary things, and I think when you apply that biomimicry principle, not just to sort of design a technology, but to, we need to look at, this is really the inspiration for new forms of social organization and governance and economics. The biomimicry strapline is nature has been researching and developing this for 3.8 billion years, so maybe we should pay some attention to that. So and again, the science and technology that's coming out of that sphere, I would say, is completely in step with this regenerative thinking, because it's inspired by these cyclical and regenerative processes that nature is a fundamentally part of biological life. But because we've got this very sort of skewed, the wonderful example, I think, of how the dominant economic and political ideology takes bits of science to support its agenda. So Darwinian thinking was seized upon for its sort of competitive survival of the fittest element that was used to sort of prop up or support the sort of imperialist colonialist agenda, which turned into sort of globalization and the rest of it, at the complete expense of cooperation and collaboration, which Darwin actually wrote more about than competition. But of course, it's been sort of sidelined from our understanding. And both of these forces are absolutely critical. And I think all life and living is this sort of constant oscillation between these two forces on every level, from a sort of atomic scale. And you could look at the way Eastern philosophies interpret this with sort of Shiva and Shakti and yin and yang and competition and collaboration and electrons are breaking. These are the driving forces. But the ideology that is at the core of our civilization is degenerative and entropic. It's not regenerative and cyclical. It's linear. It's about taking resources seeing how quickly we can turn them into rubbish and pollution, and how much money we can make along the way. And so all of these things that could actually be utilized in a much more intelligent way. And an interesting example of that, of course, is the sewage system, is how British Parliament in the mid-18th century had to be suspended for a week, I think, because of the stench from the Thames was so bad. And then eventually they reconvened and they debated in Parliament about what two types of sewage system, one of which was a linear system that would mix all the sewage with running water, divert it all into the river and out it goes to sea. And of course, that was what was adopted and then transported around the globe via colonialism. Whereas the much more intelligent sort of traditional Chinese system, for instance, was to take the sewage to the outskirts of the city, compost it, and then you return it to the soil so we don't lose all of this nutrient load, and then supplies the market gardens that then grow the vegetables that then go back into the city. So you've got a cyclical system. So what we've been doing ever since the adoption of the linear sewage system is basically stripping the living biological world of nutrients, putting it through the human metabolism, mixing it with fresh potable water and flushing it out to sea. I mean, it's really probably the stupidest thing we've done to date. Things we're doing now are probably even stupider. But that, and that was actually, there were some intelligent scientists at the time who saw what was going to happen and started developing the roots of the agrochemical industry, because they could see that we were just going to be on a one-way mission to strip the global food supply and soil of its nutrients. Mm. So all of these, so it's like the sort of ludicrous proposals now from Gates and Co. for putting all of these particles into the upper atmosphere for combating global warming. These are just downstream, linear, simplistic solutions to complex problems that they have created, and which this thinking has created, and it's driven by this completely insane belief that more of the same thinking applied to the problem is going to solve the problem. And all it's going to do is create yet more unforeseen downstream consequences. And I'm afraid, the whole geoengineering thing, I'm afraid, for years I dismissed all of this as being, but I now realise it's absolutely happening. It's been happening for a long time, and it's way, way, way more prevalent than any of us would like to believe.
And where leadership stays in these six pillars of the systems, would it be in community?
Well, I think it's a very good and interesting question, and I think that this that area probably is the. This is the one, it's always been the case, that these new forms of social organisation and governance that we need to kind of develop, no one can really articulate quite what they are because they haven't been done yet.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think we're all grappling for it. And I think what I like to believe is it's going to be a sort of an emergent property that comes out of this kind of collective process, driven by a critical mass of people, all with a sort of similar aspiration. So I think one will see this happen anyway at a community level, and one already does. There are people who naturally gravitate into sort of different positions and roles. But absolutely, as we know, I think this is look at all of the attempts to create sort of alternative and utopian communities, and how often they've sort of been so quickly derailed because of all of this issue around sort of, how do you create a democratic process and all of this. But I believe it's something that's coming, and I think we can see sort of some of the sort of seeds of it emerging in different places. But I think, it's definitely, but as always with all of these things, I think if we look to how nature works, how an ecosystem works, that it's probably, again, like so many things, we're so conditioned by our sort of understanding of what a political system looks like, that we're sort of in a way still constrained by that. We're kind of, I suppose, still sort of hoping that people are going to sort of step into the limelight, who are going to just sort of change direction for everything. And I wish that would happen. I'd love that to happen. But sadly, the anybody of sort of integrity and sort of stature, I think these days in the political arena, just doesn't even get a look in, because they just they're not even drawn to going there in the first place.
they are maybe so worried about the downstream symptoms that they are not looking at
it. It's just so unattractive to go in, because it's just thing is just, and you can see how any politician with integrity and vision just, you know, it's just ends up just having to kind of walk away, because they're just very soon in deep water.
Do you think this global situation will create a kind of two or more than two, like different states of awareness of people living in different systems, let's say, in the same world?
I think that's definitely possible. And sort of happening maybe already. I mean, I'm amazed looking in from the outside to say the UK at the moment. And I noticed when I moved between Ibiza and the UK quite regularly until sort of 18 months ago, I did, every time I went back, I'd noticed this sort of transition into this sort of slightly, you know, this rather sort of different sort of collective consciousness that is, you know, by the time I'd sort of got out of the tube in central London, I was sort of in the matrix to some degree. You know, you're bombarded by mainstream media and I'd get back here and just that feeling of walking out of the airport here, which I think so many of us experience, but it just became more and more pronounced that I was just, things were just operating in a different sort of frequency here to what they were in central London.
yes, for sure. And to close the conversation, I'd like to talk more about Ibiza and the different projects, the different regenerative agricultural projects that are here at the moment. They are growing a lot. Mostly they are funded by privates wanting to explore more about this system, or yes, that they are like feeling this urge of change. And they are starting these initiatives. Do you think there is the need for more governmental support in these initiatives, or would you keep them private so they don't have so much influence?
It's a fantastic question, and I don't necessarily feel qualified to answer it because I'm just not involved. And certainly when I was in Sri Lanka, it was, because we had an agricultural project and there were all sorts of incentives to sort of go. But I soon realised that sort of getting entangled with a Sri Lankan, as a foreigner, getting with a Sri Lankan government department, as attractive as it might appear on face level for the subsidies, was only going to bring an absolute sort of nightmare headache in terms of bureaucracy and interference and the rest of it. So I don't know, but I think where everyone is, and this is the problem, is like, how do we marry, or is where lies the interface between this kind of sort of new regenerative paradigm, for want of another, because it doesn't, you know, as much as the people in local government or might resonate 100% with whatever this initiative might be, like a rejection. The problem is, of course, his hands are going to be tied by all sorts of powerful economic interests that are coming from a sort of centralised dictum. So suddenly he'll find that he's incapable of supporting something in the way that he wants to, because actually there's some, you know, crafty little bit of legalese that is designed to actually get in the way of this stuff. And I'm afraid, yeah, this is the reality, because, and again, you know, we're so led to believe that these industrialized agricultures, monocultures, are necessary to feed the world, but they just are. They produce 20 to 30% of the world's food supply. Most of it, you know, three different, you know, rice, wheat and maize, and then a whole plethora of bastardised processed food products which have got zero nutrition and, you know, just designed to give you high blood pressure and cancer and diabetes. But actually, ultimately, we don't need them. You know, certainly not to feed the world. Something like, you know, Vandana Shiva says that, you know, something like 80% of the world's food supply is still grown by sort of rural peasant farmers. I've also heard closer to 70%. So I think that's a really interesting thing to bear in mind. So this notion that we need genetically modified crops, I mean, it's just nonsense. This is just pure economic political spin. It's just nonsense. And really, and I do, yeah, anybody who's interested in these issues, you know, this book I'm reading at the moment called A Small Farm Future by a guy called Chris Smage, S-M-A-J-E, published by Chelsea Green Publishing, and is the most definitive book I've read around all of these issues. It's only just come out a few months ago. But it takes this whole sort of regenerative farming movement and places it within a much sort of wider kind of context, you know, politically and economically. But the first part of the book just shows you so conclusively that none of these projections from the dominant ideology certainly around feeding the world just can't come close. It's just never going to do it. It's only going to ruin the environment ever faster, ever quicker, and not feed the world. And that a small farm future, if there is to be a future for humanity, is at the moment nobody has produced a more viable option. So I really, really recommend that book. It's fascinating. So yeah, I think it's interesting times, challenging times, very dark times, but also incredibly exciting times. Suddenly sort of anything seems possible.
So yeah, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Anna. And it's theregeneration.me. It's a little out of date at the moment because I've not been very active in the last few months because of a boring health issue, which thankfully, hopefully, touch wood, is now coming to a close. And I'm looking forward to getting much more active in this area again, from sort of September onwards.
Yeah.
And there is, so do sign up to on the website, because I'm probably going to be coming off all social media soon anyway. So if you're interested to get information, please register on the website. And there is a Patreon way to support the work too, for which I'd be immensely grateful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you so much, Rory.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
Sorry.